What defines success for you? What measurement of achievement do you use to evaluate fulfillment in life? How do you identify an accomplishment, an achievement, or a victory? For many people, the answers to those questions often include things like the acquisition of money, status, or numerous possessions. But in the world of the Old Testament, a successful life was usually marked by three basic characteristics: financial wealth, a large number of children, and a lifespan that stretched well into old age. Like a person of status and recognition today, the person who lived a long life with numerous children and great financial resources was someone who was worthy of great honor and respect in the days of the Old Testament. However, the simple acquisition of any of these things does not automatically guarantee that we'll receive contentment, fulfillment, satisfaction from any of them. In other words, those things that may appear to guarantee a certain level of status, achievement, and recognition in life may not always deliver what they seem to offer. This reality is illustrated by the old saying that warns us to be careful what you wish for, you might get it. Another author once illustrated this idea by saying, "There are two tragedies in life. One is not to get your heart's desire. The other is to get it." While these realities may be difficult enough, there's something else to consider. For example, poor health, unforeseen circumstances, or other responsibilities may all serve to impact our ability to enjoy the things we've achieved. And if we really want to be honest about it, the truth is that some things in life may initially seem to be good, but actually turn out to be bad. Some things that originally seem to be bad actually turn out to be good. So the reality is that the cultural gauges of success may not always guarantee a feeling of satisfaction in life. Just as hardships, difficulties, or misfortunes don't always lead to dissatisfaction. So how can we tell which is which? Well, it's not always possible to tell a difference, unless we take the viewpoint that focuses on God and His plan for our lives. This is something that the teacher will begin to explore here in Ecclesiastes chapter 6. The first two verses of Ecclesiastes chapter 6 begin with the following statement: "There is another serious tragedy I've seen under the sun, and it weighs heavily on humanity. God gives some people great wealth and honor, and everything they could ever want. But then, He doesn't give them the chance to enjoy these things. They die, and someone else, even a stranger, ends up enjoying their wealth. This is meaningless, a sickening tragedy." The scriptures tell us that Solomon displayed a great number of God-given talents, skills, and abilities during his reign as king of Israel. For example, the Old Testament book of 1 Kings describes Solomon as a wise judge, skilled executive, a prolific poet and writer, and a prominent botanist as well. Yet, hidden among these capabilities is another of Solomon's talents that may be easy to overlook, and that is his keen sense of observation and analysis. Most people probably recognize the value of experience in making good judgments. The problem is that experience often comes from making bad judgments. Although Solomon definitely made some bad judgments in life, he was able to address this problem by using his ability to observe, analyze, and learn from the experiences of others. In this instance, Solomon observed a common experience that he identified as evil, unfair, and a serious injustice. God gives great wealth, riches, and honor to some people. They have everything they want, but God does not let them enjoy such things. From a strictly horizontal perspective, or under the sun to use Solomon's terminology, it would certainly seem very unfair for God to allow someone to possess something without the capacity to enjoy it. But what if we were to employ some observational skills of our own to ask why God would allow something like that to occur? Well, a few possible answers to that question might be found within the Old Testament book of Proverbs. For instance, Proverbs chapter 10, verse 2 tells us, "Ill-gotten gain brings no lasting happiness. Right living does." In Proverbs chapter 10, verse 22, we read, "The blessing of the Lord brings wealth, and he adds no trouble to it." Finally, Proverbs chapter 15, verse 6 adds, "The house of the righteous contains great treasure, but the income of the wicked brings them trouble." If the blessings we've received are causing us trouble, then it may be time to adjust our vertical perspective to determine if we are using those blessings in the way that God intended. So, on the surface, it might seem grossly unfair for God to allow someone to possess something, but keep that person from enjoying what he has given to him. But before we jump to conclusions concerning God's motives in this area, let's first stop to consider what he might be trying to accomplish. For instance, Jesus once offered the following counsel in Luke chapter 12, verse 15. "Watch out, be on your guard against all kinds of greed. Life does not consist in an abundance of possessions." He then followed this advice with a short story or parable that was designed to illustrate an important spiritual truth. Jesus said, "The ground of a certain rich man yielded an abundant harvest. He thought to himself, 'What shall I do? I have no place to store my crops.' Then he said, 'This is what I'll do. I will tear down my barns and build bigger ones, and there I will store my surplus grain. And I'll say to myself, you have plenty of grain laid up for many years. Take life easy, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who will get what you have prepared for yourself? This is how it will be with whoever stores up things for themselves, but is not rich toward God. Like the rich man who was denied the opportunity to enjoy the riches he possessed, God may sometimes choose to keep someone from enjoying his or her blessings in order to focus that person's attention on the giver instead of the gift. Others may fail to find enjoyment in their possessions by using those things in a way that doesn't honor God. Consider this biblical admonition from James chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. What causes fights and quarrels among you? Don't they come from your desires that battle within you? You want something, but don't get it. You kill and covet, but you cannot have what you want. You quarrel and fight. You do not have because you do not ask God. When you ask, you do not receive because you ask with wrong motives, that you may spend what you get on your pleasures." So these examples help remind us to keep an important recommendation from Romans chapter 15, verse 4 in mind. Everything that was written in the past is written to teach us. Verse 3 then continues by saying, "A man might have 100 children and live to be very old, but if he finds no satisfaction in life and doesn't even get a decent burial, it would have been better for him to have been born dead." In the days of the Old Testament, a large and growing family was viewed as a valuable asset, a sign of God's divine favor. Children were essential to maintaining the lineage of each family in a society where the record of someone's genealogy was more than just an interesting hobby. It represented an important legal and historical account. Children also served as shepherds, shepherdesses, and farmers, and helped the family maintain a local economy that was largely focused on ranching and agriculture. So the idea of a man with 100 children served to represent a person who had been blessed almost beyond belief. But then again, Solomon had 700 wives and 300 secondary wives or concubines, so perhaps this illustration isn't as far-fetched as it may initially appear. If the overwhelming abundance of children wasn't enough for this hypothetical illustration, the teacher also went on to add the additional benefit of a long life. Later on in verse 6, he will build upon this idea by saying he might live 1,000 years twice over, but still not find contentment. A 2,000-year lifespan was more than twice as long as the oldest recorded lifespan in the scriptures. So the idea of a greatly extended lifetime served to reinforce the concept of a person who had been blessed well beyond any reasonable expectation. These illustrations help paint the word picture of someone who had it all in life. Person who enjoyed the pleasure of 100 descendants, each one carrying his own personal genetic distinctiveness forward for centuries to come. A person who enjoyed the good health necessary to support a 2,000-year lifespan. A person who clearly enjoyed the good life with all the outward signs of a prosperous and satisfying life. Unfortunately, it's been said that all good things must come to an end. Teacher will go on to take that idea into account as part of his illustration as well. In the world of Solomon's day, the way that someone died was almost as important as the way that he or she lived, and the teacher mentioned one additional item that marked the conclusion of a seemingly fulfilling Old Testament life, an honorable burial. For example, when Sarah, the wife of the great Old Testament patriarch Abraham, passed away, Abraham purchased an expensive burial site for use as her final resting place. Later on, Abraham, his son Isaac, and daughter-in-law Rebekah, grandson Jacob, along with Jacob's wife Leah, were laid to rest there as well. However, the best example of this mindset may have been displayed by Jacob's son Joseph. Even though God had placed Joseph in a position of honor and prominence within the Egyptian government, the importance of securing a final resting place in the land that God had promised to give to his ancestors was at the forefront of his mind at the time of his death, according to Genesis chapter 50, verses 24 to 26, which tell us this. Then Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob." Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, "God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up from this place." So Joseph died at the age of 110. While this passage clearly focuses on Joseph's faith in God to fulfill the promises he had given to his forefathers, his desire for a final resting place in the Promised Land, the land of his birth, seems clear as well. And even though Joseph's coffin remained in Egypt for the next 4 centuries, God made certain to grant his request according to Joshua chapter 24, verse 32, where we read this. When the people of Israel left Egypt, they brought the bones of Joseph along with them. They took the bones to the town of Shechem and buried them in the field that Jacob had bought for 100 pieces of silver from Hamor, the founder of Shechem. The town and the field both became part of the land belonging to the descendants of Joseph. Verses 4 to 6 of Ecclesiastes chapter 6 then continue by saying, his birth would have been meaningless, and he would have ended in darkness. He wouldn't have even had a name, and he would never have seen the sun or known of his existence. Yet he would have more peace than in growing up to be an unhappy man. He might live 1,000 years twice over, but still not find contentment, since he must die like everyone else. Well, what's the use? William Shakespeare's play Hamlet contains one of the most well-known quotations in all literature. To be or not to be, that is the question. However, these verses tell us that the teacher of Ecclesiastes pondered a similar question thousands of years earlier. For Solomon, the question was this. Was it better for someone to die at birth rather than live out a worthless existence under the sun? From the teacher's perspective, there seemed to be very little point in living if everything in life is meaningless. Even if someone were to attain all the external characteristics of success in life, how would that person ultimately be better off than a child who died at birth? This is ground that Solomon has already covered in the book of Ecclesiastes, and for him, the idea of a meaningless world was so painful and depressing that death or a state of non-existence seemed to be the best option of all. One commentator served to sum up this thought process when he said, "Better to miscarry at birth than to miscarry throughout life." Solomon based this reasoning on 2 observations about life under the sun, or a life lived without acknowledgement of God. First, a child who dies at birth will never experience the ultimate futility of an empty and unfulfilling life, even if that life is filled with things that are supposed to bring happiness and satisfaction. Secondly, a stillborn child will never have to live with a realization that his or her life will soon be forgotten after death. In the words of another commentator, if life is nothing more than a meaningless journey to death, then a stillborn child is better off, for that child reaches the end of the worthless journey with far less pain. These verses point the way to a depressing reality for the person who lives his or her life without regard for God or an afterlife. If this life is all there is to our short, painful, unfulfilling existence, then death may seem to be the best option of all. Verses 7 and 8, we then go on to read, all people spend their lives scratching for food, but they never seem to have enough. So, are wise people really better off than fools? Do poor people gain anything by being wise and knowing how to act in front of others? Have you ever had the experience of walking near a kitchen, restaurant, or other location where food was being prepared and enjoyed the aroma of a delicious meal as it was being created? Well, the ability to take pleasure in a good meal is a blessing from God that should never be taken for granted. Yet even the most satisfying and enjoyable cuisine imaginable still leaves someone hungry after just a short while. No matter how much effort we put into satisfying our appetites, we still must work to eat on a daily basis. This fundamental truth exists for everyone, regardless of race, culture, social, or economic status. Everyone must work to eat. This cold, hard reality presented the teacher with a difficult question. What advantage does a wise person have over a fool? What advantage does a poor person have in learning how to face life? As a teacher, author, and communicator, Solomon had a rich supply of literary devices available to effectively convey his message. In this instance, the teacher chose to employ a rhetorical question, a figure of speech where a question is asked for emphasis or effect. This question was not designed to obtain any information because the answer was clearly implied. A wise person has little or no advantage over a fool or someone with limited resources because they both share the same ultimate fate. It's not that wisdom fails to offer any short-term advantages, but that wisdom fails to offer any ultimate advantage over those who are foolish. He then continues in verse 9 by saying, enjoy what you have rather than desiring what you don't have. Just dreaming about nice things is meaningless, like chasing the wind. Another biblical translation renders the first part of this verse in a somewhat more poetic form. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the desire. The idea is that it's better to have relatively little and really enjoy what you possess, instead of living in an unrealistic dream world that's filled with everything you might like to have someday. Much as the teacher said earlier, talk is cheap, like daydreams and other useless activities. Fear God instead. To do otherwise, in the words of the teacher, makes no more sense than chasing the wind. Now, at this point, we can stop for a moment to make the following observation. Ecclesiastes chapter 6:10 marks the midpoint of this book, and if we wanted to identify the basic message of Ecclesiastes so far, we can find a good summary in chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. Anything I wanted, I would take. I denied myself no pleasure. I even found great pleasure in hard work, a reward for all my labors. But as I looked at everything I had worked so hard to accomplish, it was all so meaningless, like chasing the wind. There was nothing really worthwhile anywhere. So again, if everything is meaningless, then what's the point of life? This question led the teacher back to a familiar but fatalistic response in verse 10. Everything has already been decided. It was known long ago what each person would be. So there's no use arguing with God about your destiny. Having tried and failed to find meaning in life apart from his Creator, Solomon had little choice but to return to acknowledging God as a source of meaning in life. The problem was that his under-the-sun view of God's relationship to humanity was more robotic than human. Solomon's point was that any attempt to argue or complain about God's predetermined direction would only lead to frustration and disappointment. This is something that the teacher has struggled with before, and it's something that people often struggle with today. One way to address this concept is to return to something that we established earlier. The fact that God knows our choices in advance does not necessarily mean that we are no longer free to make those choices. Instead, we could say that God directs human history by incorporating our free choice into His ultimate plan. In other words, God controls the world by what He knows people will freely do. And knowing what people will do with their freedom is not the same as ordaining what they must do against their freedom. In this way, God works so that people are reverent before Him, according to chapter 3, verse 14. You see, people may sometimes seek to contend with God regarding the circumstances and events of their lives. Some might even anticipate the opportunity to put God on trial, so to speak, in the afterlife and stand in judgment over His choices for their lives. But as we pointed out earlier, some things in life may initially seem bad but actually turn out to be good. Some things that originally seem to be good actually turn out to be bad. Only God knows the end from the beginning, and He is the one who ultimately works all things together for the good of those who love God and are called according to His purpose, according to Romans chapter 8, verse 28. Verse 11 then goes on to say, "The more words you speak, the less they mean. So what good are they?" A number of years ago, a prominent athlete for a well-known sports team was criticized for some comments made following a particularly difficult loss. This athlete was well known as an outspoken Christian and someone who openly discussed his faith in Christ. However, this player was also known as a person who liked to talk at length, and he was often quoted extensively in the newspapers of that time. In the locker room following the team's defeat, this athlete was asked to summarize the reason for his team's loss. The player proceeded to describe the team's failure in a manner that was later criticized as thoughtless and insensitive towards a particular group. In light of that criticism, the athlete later apologized for his careless choice of words. In the days following that episode, two fans of the team were discussing the player's remarks. One fan had difficulty understanding why the player had chosen to say what he did. "I thought he was religious," the fan said. "Why would he say something like that?" The second fan replied by saying, "He is religious, but when you talk as much as that guy does, it's only a matter of time before you say something stupid." This real-life parable helps to provide a good illustration for the passage quoted here from Ecclesiastes chapter 6. While the primary meaning of this passage involves a statement about the futility of life under the sun, there is a secondary application for those who are willing to look a little deeper. In saying, "The more words there are, the more pointless they become, what advantage do mortals gain from this?" the answer is assumed to be nothing. So this helps remind us to choose our words carefully, lest they multiply and devolve into something pointless. While the teacher has already covered this theme within the book of Ecclesiastes, this basic idea is also found in a number of other scriptural passages as well. For example, Proverbs chapter 10, verse 19 tells us, "When words are many, sin is not absent, but he who holds his tongue is wise." In Proverbs chapter 29, verse 20, we read, "Do you see a man who speaks in haste? There is more hope for a fool than for him." Finally, James chapter 1, verse 19 tells us, "My dear brothers, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry." In Matthew chapter 12, verse 36, Jesus also said, "I can guarantee that on Judgment Day, people will have to give an account of every careless word they say." That, by itself, should provide enough encouragement to think carefully before we speak. Verse 12 then continues by saying, "In the few days of our meaningless lives, who knows how our days can best be spent? Our lives are like a shadow. Who can tell what will happen on this earth after we are gone?" As we enter now into the second half of the book of Ecclesiastes, we'll find that our author is moving back towards an acknowledgement of God as the only real source of meaning and purpose in life. One subtle example of this shift in perspective can be found by looking at the questions contained within this verse. Who knows how our days can best be spent, and who can tell what will happen on this earth after we are gone? While there may be no shortage of people who are willing to provide their opinion in answering these questions, there is only one who is truly qualified to speak on these subjects. You see, we often think we know how to decide what's best for us in life, but concepts like best or good are only as reliable as the information that those decisions are based upon. The problem is that people rarely have all the information they need to make good decisions. Because of this, we are often forced to make decisions in life based upon whatever information is known to us at the time. If more information then becomes available later on, the wisdom or foolishness of a particular decision may then be revealed. This is why people are often heard to say things like, "If I only knew then what I know now," after making a bad decision. Experience or inexperience, personal bias, peer pressure, and the advice and opinions of others may also serve to influence the decision-making process for better or worse. This is why the questions found in Ecclesiastes chapter 6, verse 12 help shift our focus from an under-the-sun perspective to a viewpoint that acknowledges God and His plan for our lives. By asking, "Who knows how our days can best be spent?" and "Who can tell what will happen on this earth after we are gone?" Solomon has left the answer unstated but unavoidable. The answer is no one except God. Proverbs chapter 3, verses 5 and 6 tell us, "Trust in the Lord with all your heart, and lean not on your own understanding. In all your ways acknowledge Him, and He will make your path straight." While we may not have the ability to understand everything that occurs during our short existence here under the sun, God is worthy of our trust in providing wisdom and direction for every aspect of our lives.